there. Welcome. Today is Wednesday, October the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump's diehard supporters. Who are they?
We have a couple of political movements right now in this country that are pretty frustrated and angry, and for the first time in a while are making their voices heard.
A preview of what to expect in tomorrow's final presidential debate. President Obama and First Lady Michelle host their last state dinner at the White House. Also ahead, a global competition with a big payout to combat adult illiteracy. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump are meeting in Las Vegas, Nevada, Wednesday for their third and final presidential debate as Trump continues to trail Clinton in public polls, and Wednesday's debate may be his final opportunity to change the trajectory of the race with less than 3 weeks to go until Election Day. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports from Washington.
The final debate looms is crucial for Donald Trump, who trails Hillary Clinton by an average of 6 percentage points in recent national polls. Trump continues to warn supporters they are fighting the Clinton political machine and a biased news media.
This is a rigged system, folks, but we're not going to let it happen.
Even some Republicans have rejected Trump's claim. Trump has also lashed out at allegations from numerous women who have accused him of making improper sexual advances in the past.
These are lies being pushed by the media and the Clinton campaign to try and keep their grip on our country. They are all false. They're totally invented. Fiction. All 100% totally and completely fabricated.
Clinton has been immersed in debate prep in recent days. Despite continuing controversy over her emails, she's tried to keep her campaign focused on the issues.
Number one, we've got to get the economy working for everyone, not just those at the top. And we can do this.
Clinton is getting help on the campaign trail from President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, who noted Trump's vulgar comments about women in a recently released videotape.
This was a powerful individual speaking freely and openly about sexually predatory behavior.
Trump has slipped in some polls in the wake of the salacious video and the allegations from several women, says analyst Tom DeFrank.
This is not the behavior that's going to endear him to college-educated white women. That's who he needs.
Trump and Clinton likely have different approaches to the final debate, says Republican strategist John Feary.
I think Hillary is going to play it safe because I think she believes she has the lead. I think Trump is going to go for broke because he believes that he's got to make ground and really kind of attack her.
In the final weeks of the campaign, both candidates will focus on a handful of so-called swing states where the election outcome will be decided. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump's rise to the Republican presidential nomination has been driven by some of America's forgotten white working class poor, as some are describing. Joining me to talk about this neglected demographic, J.D. Vance. He's the author of the memoir Hillbilly Elegy. It's now number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. Thank you for being with us. You really do have a personal understanding of this segment of the population. It's how you were raised, which you talk about a lot in your memoir.
That group of people, whether they're relatively poor or whether they're lower middle income, have, in a lot of ways, I think, not done especially well. They haven't done especially well on a number of indicators, not just economically, but socially, the eviction epidemic, mortality rates, family dissolution, and so forth. And that's who the book is about. And if you look just at the sort of data, that's who Trump is especially popular among. It. If you look at his base of support, it's white voters without a college education in these areas of the country. So I guess it's somewhat fortunate for the book's success, at least, that Trump came along now. And obviously a lot of people are asking questions about the people who are voting for him.
And you are someone who lived through that type of upbringing. Why would you say this group of people gravitate to him the way they have?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things going on. First of all, I think the tone that Trump conducts himself with, how unfiltered he is, he's sort of loud and boisterous and occasionally funny, it reminds people of the way that they may talk about politics around the dinner table. So there's something very relatable in the tone and the way that he conducts himself. He's not filtered. He doesn't sound like everything he says is poll tested and consultant approved. And so a lot of people like that. I think there's also a substantive reason that people are voting for him, which is that, you know, things have not gone especially well in these areas. You know, whether you're talking about the decline of manufacturing jobs, the difficulty of finding a good wage, the housing crisis, the addiction crisis, rising mortality rates, there are a number of those different indicators that suggest that people in this area are not doing especially well, and they've long been frustrated by the political elites of both parties who they feel aren't doing anything to make it better. So along comes Donald Trump, and he runs not just against the Democratic elites, but also the Republican elites. And that's been a breath of fresh air for people who feel ignored and frustrated.
His life isn't remotely like theirs. Why are they so willing to trust that he will care?
You know, there are a couple of responses. One, I don't think that everybody thinks that he necessarily will care. You know, a lot of the people I know who are voting for Donald Trump, they don't necessarily love Donald Trump. They just dislike Hillary Clinton, and they disliked his Republican challengers before him. So it's not so much a pro-Trump vote as it is a rejection of the alternatives, which in a lot of people's eyes have been pretty bad. The second thing I'll say is that there's something very important, not just about your personal background if you're a political candidate, but also about the tone that you bring to political conversations. So think about Bill Clinton, who was very, very popular among the white working class. He was, of course, a Yale-educated, pretty elite guy, but he downplayed all of that. He didn't play up his wealth and his you know, his fame, his elite credentials. If you think about the way that Donald Trump talks to voters, he talks about caring about the uneducated, he talks about caring about the construction worker or the coal miner. There's something to be said just for talking and getting yourself in front of a crowd and speaking to the crowd in a way that relates to them, even if you yourself aren't totally relatable.
The wounds are pretty deep in this country when it comes to race and class.
That's certainly true. There are a lot of people who feel justifiably so that they've been ignored in one way or the other, either because, you know, they're black and political elites don't care about their problems, or maybe because they're white working class and people don't care about their problems. I don't think that our political class has done a very good job at addressing the concerns of a lot of these voters. And so it's unsurprising that we have a couple of political movements right now in this country that are pretty frustrated and angry, and for the first time in a while are making their voices heard.
We talked about this group of people. Many of them are diehard supporters of Donald Trump. He even once said, we've all heard, that he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and they wouldn't care. They would still support him. And recently there have been a lot of allegations regarding sexual misconduct, and they're still supporting him and they don't believe it. And it almost seems like to them he's like their messiah.
Well, yeah, I mean, so again, I sort of restate the point I made earlier, which is that it's not so much about how much people love Donald Trump as much as it is about how much they hate the alternatives. That's sort of point one. The second point is that the issue with a lot of the criticism that's been levied against Donald Trump, or a lot of the accusations that have been levied against Donald Trump, and I say this as someone who believes these accusations and think that he's a pretty disgusting person, is that they're coming from the same sources that have really lost credibility among the white working class. You know, Donald Trump loves to make fun of CNN, and people get excited and they cheer when he makes fun of CNN because they themselves see CNN as a sort of representative of a media establishment that isn't telling the truth and doesn't ultimately care about their concerns. So the issue here, to me, is not so much a loyalty to Donald Trump. It's a deep, deep mistrust of many of the institutions of our society, in this specific case, the media. I don't think that is going to go away even when Donald Trump loses. That mistrust of the media, the unwillingness to believe things that the media tells you, it's not going to go away. And I think that's driving this, again, more than any special love for Donald Trump.
That's author J.D. Vance. He's written a memoir called Hillbilly Elegy of a Family and a Culture in Crisis. We appreciate your being with us. Turning now to what's trending online, we are joined by G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
So Netflix no longer in China, right?
That's right. The streaming video service issued an earnings report on Monday, and in the report, Netflix acknowledged its expansion plans in China were not successful. The reason being, in its own words, the regulatory environment for foreign digital content services in China has become challenging.
I guess that shouldn't come as a huge surprise to people that know much about, you know, the...
how Beijing works.
Right, yeah. Exactly. What are people, how are people responding to that, I guess, with not a huge amount of surprise?
Yeah, people are joking Netflix's new brilliant strategy for China is to stay the hell out of there. And people are tweeting quite accurately that no homosexuality, no witchcraft equals no Netflix in China. That's because Beijing doesn't allow certain topics to be covered in popular culture. Instead, the company will spend $6 billion on content production.
Wow, okay. Anything else interesting trending?
Sure. The next story is also from an American company. Delta Airlines is trending on social media with people sharing photos of its new uniforms. Delta collaborated with New York fashion designer Zac Posen to create new uniforms for more than 60,000 employees, and it's mostly in gray, purple, and red. Online users are saying they like the throwback to the 60s and 70s, and Lori, the flight attendant's uniforms definitely look like they were inspired by Jackie O. And another thing I found interesting is that some of the new Delta travel bags for employees are now on eBay for, guess this, around $150 each.
Whoa.
They're cute.
I wonder if the employees are actually allowed to sell them.
Probably not.
Well, we have time for one more story. What do you have?
We have little words of encouragement from north of the border. Canadians took to YouTube to tell us what they admire and like about America using hashtag TellAmericaItsGreat. In the video, they mentioned the U.S. government created the internet, hugely important, that we have diversity here, we are a giving nation, and that we have very expansive national parks. I found it interesting that a lot of people also noted American music, including jazz and bluegrass, is great. All right, that's all for me today. Lori, back to you.
All right, thanks so much, G. And you can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Iran sentences an Iranian-American and his elderly father to 10 years in prison. Temporary calm in Aleppo after days of heavy bombing. Ecuador says it has restricted WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's internet link. And a study finds anti-inflammatory drugs also fight depression. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Barack Obama has welcomed Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to the White House, hosting the final official state visit by a foreign leader of his presidency. The Italian leader and his wife were welcomed Tuesday on the lawn of the White House with, as is custom, full military honors, and invited guests of Italian Americans were there to observe.
Few are as strong and as reliable and as capable as Italy. In good times and in bad, we can count on each other. And I want to thank the government and the people of Italy for the hospitality and the generosity they show to the many American military personnel and families who are stationed in Italy far away from home.
Well, the Obamas also honored the visiting Italian leader and his wife by hosting their final White House state dinner along with the state visit.
This marks the final official visit and state dinner of my presidency. But it's okay. We've saved the best for last.
All right, well, Michelle Obama dazzled at her final state dinner as First Lady, wearing a floor-length rose gold gown. Mrs. Obama has a tradition of wearing dresses to state dinners by designers who represent the nation being honored. The United Nations said Tuesday that 36 hours into the Iraqi and Kurdish military offensive to liberate Mosul from Islamic State, it hasn't so far seen any immediate large outflows of residents from the city. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more on what could become a humanitarian issue.
The UN has expressed continued concern for civilians in the northern city and fear that as many as 1 million of them could become displaced during the battle. If that happens, it could test the international humanitarian system to the breaking point. Updating reporters on Tuesday, UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric said so far there has not been any significant displacement.
Movements out of the city have been limited, and displacement is anticipated to become more significant in the coming weeks. An estimated 200,000 people are anticipated to be displaced in the first weeks of the offensive. In a worst-case scenario, 1 million people could be displaced.
The UN has six emergency centers running near Mosul, which can receive up to 60,000 people. They expect to have 22 centers operating within the next few weeks that could accommodate more than 400,000 people. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On November 8th, American voters will choose their next president. We'll provide you with the latest updates. Will it be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Will third-party candidates like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein have an impact on the final outcome? What does that mean for Americans and the world? It's all here on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, there is a global competition underway that's challenging teams to develop mobile apps that will increase literacy skills in adults within 12 months in the United States. The goal is to help as many as 1 million adults learn to read. Joining me to talk about it, Shlomi Katan, Senior Director of Operations for the Adult Literacy X Prize Challenge. Illiteracy isn't something you'd expect in the U.S. How big of a problem is it?
You're right. This is definitely one of those things that people are not really aware of. And around the world, there are close to 800 million people who lack basic literacy skills. That's about one out of every six people, adults around the world. In the U.S., that ratio is exactly the same. There are 36 million adults in the U.S. who lack basic literacy skills. Just about 15% of the adult population.
Wow, I had no idea. So tell us about your project, the Barbara Bush Foundation Adult Literacy X Prize.
So we're trying to tackle this problem in a really innovative way. Close to 70% of adult learners have a smartphone, but currently the existing programs that are in place can only address about 5% of the entire need, right? So just about 1.5 million adult learners around the U.S. are able to access tutoring services and classes and just adult education services in general. If 70% of them have smartphones, what we want to do is have software developed that can help those adults achieve basic levels of literacy in just about 1 year. And so the Adult Literacy X Prize challenged teams from around the world to develop just such software for existing smartphones and other smart devices, so phablets and tablets as well, that can be used by adult learners on their own or with others to take them to basic levels of literacy in just about 12 months of use.
Talk a little bit about where this prize money is coming from.
And that's also a unique thing about the Adult Literacy X Prize. Our partners for the Adult Literacy X Prize are the Barbara Bush Foundation for Family Literacy and the Dollar General Literacy Foundation. Both of these organizations are leaders in the field of family and adult learning. They've been in the field for more than a quarter century each. And when they were looking at this, at the field, when they were looking at the problem of adult low literacy in the U.S., they realized that in the entire 25 years that they had been in business, they had funded a lot of great work. They're funding hundreds of organizations around the country that are providing services to adult learners. But during those 25 years, they weren't seeing any big impact. It was a lot of status quo. service is good. We know that one-on-one tutoring works. We know that literacy classes work. They just can't scale up. This idea actually came from the Barbara Bush Foundation. It actually came from their board of directors and specifically from Jeb Bush saying, you know what, if we want to have real impact in this space, if we do an X Prize, we can address this scale issue and address the access issue. And so those are the sponsors. And it's a unique thing that we've had at X Prize to be able to work with really industry leaders in the specific area that they are disrupting through a competition.
Talk a little bit about why literacy is important and what it can do to a society.
That's, I think, the crux of all of this. We obviously, as a society, know that education matters. When you have higher levels of educational attainment in a country, that the GDP of that country goes up. In fact, there's some research suggesting that a single percentage point increase in literacy rates in a country leads to a full single percentage point increase in permanent GDP growth. So obviously the effects are tremendous on society. We tend to focus a lot of our energy and our work and our resources in education on kids, and justifiably so. But education is intergenerational. The biggest predictor of a child's educational success is the educational attainment of that child's mother. And when we were looking at what impact we could have on the field, we realized that it was very important to let the good work that's being done in K-12 be done, let the good work that's being done in pre-K be done, but we really need to help address this issue of adult literacy. And a big reason for that is the intergenerational effects that it has. If we're able to ameliorate those, we're going to see tremendous effects for generations to come. It's going to affect healthcare. It's going to affect economic productivity in the country. And so those are really the reasons for doing something like this.
All right. Well, we appreciate hearing about it. Shlomi Katan, Senior Director of Operations for the Adult Literacy X Prize Challenge. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Well, a member of the popular British-Irish boy band One Direction has just released a solo single. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks about it with Border Crossing's host, Larry London.
Well, Sarah, thanks for having me on the show. And today we're looking at one member of One Direction, a band that's been around since 2012 and formed on the very popular show X Factor on TV in the UK. And they are now on hiatus, at least that's what they're calling it, although all the members of the band are off doing solo things. Zayn Malik, who just goes by Zayn now, about 6-8 months ago, released a solo album. He was the first member of the band to go solo and release a solo album, which has done very well. Now, the second member of One Direction has actually released material. His name is Niall Horan, and he's just put out a song that he wrote and recorded called This Town. And I really like the song. I really like the sound. Niall is from Ireland. He's a very popular member of the band, well-liked by all of their fans, which are called One Directioners all around the world. So I think we should check out the new Niall Horan song.
Waking up to kiss you and nobody's there. The smell of your perfume still stuck in the air. It's hard.
Okay, well, if members of One Direction are now doing solo albums, does this mean the group might break up?
Sarah, you've asked the question of the hour. That's what all the fans want to know. Although, this past week, one of the guys in the band posted that a reunion is absolutely a possibility. Although when they first separated back in March, they said this is only going to be a short-term thing. This is only going to be about a year. We need a breather. They just came off the road, just finished promoting their fifth album. And so we all believed and bought into that story. But then Harry Styles went off and filmed Dunkirk, signed a solo contract with Columbia Records, recorded three solo songs which have yet to be released, and the other guys in the band also working on solo material. Liam is at home taking care of his newborn son, Freddie, and Louis is working on solo material. So all the guys are doing stuff. They're involved in other things, and it's looking less and less likely that they will reunite, at least anytime soon. And this often happens, like NSYNC and all those bands that kind of go in different directions. They tend not to get back together when they've achieved success as solo artists. And Niall is on his way with his very first song now.
Okay, well, best of luck to him and to the other members of One Direction. Thanks very much, Larry. That is Larry London. He is the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
As if the whole world was watching, I'd still dance with you. Drive highways and byways, be there with you. Over and over, the only truth, everything comes back to you.
This is Science in a Minute.
A 2015 report by the World Health Organization shows that between 30 to almost 60% of traffic accident deaths in South Africa, Canada, United States, Australia, and France can be blamed on drunk driving. While increased law enforcement and awareness of the dangers of alcohol-impaired driving has lowered fatality statistics, technology is also stepping in to keep drunk drivers off the road. A group of nanoengineers, electrical and computing engineers at the University of California, San Diego, have taken their combined know-how to develop a tiny tattoo-like device that provides an easy and quick way for drivers to monitor their alcohol intake. This new device detects alcohol levels in a person's perspiration and then sends the data to a cell phone or other monitoring station. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of International Edition. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Tune in tomorrow for our live coverage of the third and final presidential debate. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region is a critical national commitment that focuses on regional prosperity and sharpening the U.S. military edge, Defense Secretary Ash Carter said on September 29th in San Diego, California. Asia-Pacific remains the single most consequential region for America's future, he said. The rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region, which President Barack Obama announced 5 years ago, includes diplomatic, economic, and military components, he explained. All of the components, Secretary Carter said, are to ensure the Asia-Pacific region remains a place where every nation can rise and prosper, even at a time of dramatic political, economic, and security change in the region. Secretary Carter highlighted security challenges in the region, including North Korea's nuclear saber-rattling that threatens allies and heightens tensions. Other challenges, he said, include maritime concerns that could hurt the region's prosperous future, as well as terrorism and transnational threats. The U.S. military, he noted, faced 5 major challenges: Russian aggression and coercion, China behaving aggressively, North Korean missile and nuclear provocations, Iranian aggression and malign influence in the Gulf, and defeating the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region has 3 parts, Secretary Carter explained. The first phase began 5 years ago, when the U.S. Department of Defense enhanced its military force posture in the region. The second phase launched last year, when the U.S. made qualitative improvements to its force posture. And the third phase will cement the progress made in the first and second phases, the secretary said. The United States will continue to invest and make high-tech improvements in its military assets to sharpen our military edge so we remain the most powerful military in the region and the security partner of choice, he added. Secretary Carter highlighted the strong ties the U.S. military has with its many allies in the region. America's regional partnerships are growing in number and strength, he said, noting that the effort entails helping to unlock the tremendous potential in the region. Secretary Carter concluded, the rebalance is about the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for, what's